Up next on Stack Overflow, Joel and Jeff discuss Rock Band 2, the big universe of dumb programmers, and the general anthropology of developing social software from IT Conversations.
Everything's going to fall apart this week. Like, I'm surprised my hair isn't literally falling out.
What, based on your move, I'm guessing?
Yep. So the first problem was that we had to delay the move, and so we scheduled all these, like, Verizon to move the phone lines and the that kind of stuff. And and then we delayed the move, and so we rescheduled that, and they didn't really cancel the turning off of various lines. So the entire office is now operating off of one DSL line. The old office.
Awesome.
So that is to explain why we may have lousy sound quality.
Sounds okay at the moment.
They disconnected our fax line, and so basically we used to have like five phone lines to the office, and now we have four, and everybody's always using them, and various machines are crashing, and the aquarium's falling apart, and it's just – the old place is just going to be a complete disaster area by the time we leave. It's going to be totally trashed.
Right. Well, moves can be pretty traumatic. I think that's somewhat normal for a move.
Have you ever done that? And you know, here at your house, your office that you leave behind, when you leave it, you're like, what a dumpster. How did we ever work there? Because when you take away all the stuff that you use, all that's left is this garbage that was hiding in the corners of the stuff that you use.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And everything, you take down all the little pictures off the wall, and there's like a rectangle where the paint is still clean behind the pictures.
Well, so if the leaving part is painful, what about the arriving? Is the arriving part going to be as traumatic as the leaving?
Well, we're supposed to have internet in the new place. In fact, we've had it in the new place on a different floor, and so they just have to move floors, which shouldn't be so hard. And so far, we haven't been able to get the people who install the locks on the doors to agree to come in time.
Ooh.
I don't know what that means, like bicycle locks on the doors or something? I don't really know how we're going to deal with that.
Yeah, not being able to get in might be sort of a showstopper.
We could get one of those super strong, incredible New York bicycle locks. What are they called? Kryptonite New York bicycle lock. And then we could issue every day a big pen that they could use to get in. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah. The pen thing where it was very controversial because somebody posted a video of how to break into the lock using nothing but just like a standard pen.
You take the cap of a big pen and you put it in where the key goes and you turn and the lock pops open. That was all you had to do.
Yeah, I think that was an early example of sort of the power of the internet. I mean, that was changing the way people design products. And because in the olden days, let's say somebody knew that exploit, right?
Yeah.
How would they get that information out to the world? They really couldn't.
Yeah, right. It would be in these. Yeah, it would be in these like lock picking magazines and stuff, but that it wouldn't really be readily known.
Right, but in an era of YouTube, it's in front of everybody. So.
Yeah. Oh, and even before YouTube, I mean, you could write about it, but nobody can read, so they wouldn't care.
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, it's weird to think about. Like, YouTube didn't exist until, like, really 2005. I think it existed a little earlier, but nobody knew about it. Mm-hmm. It's like you go back, and I remember even going back through my blog entries, and you'll say, gee, why didn't I put a video here? You know, and it's because YouTube didn't really exist then. The landscape has changed so dramatically, it's, like, hard to even imagine. And maybe not even YouTube, but just the fact that video can be posted, right, by a lot of people. Is really common. So yeah, no, I think that's a huge step in the evolution of the internet / TV. I mean, it's a big deal. Like you said, a lot of people don't like to read, so the audience just went up by maybe like a factor of 10, maybe.
Yeah. You can tell that certainly the people that post comments on YouTube can't read or write.
Yeah. Very true. Well, I hope things smooth out for your move, because we're going to be there. We did buy tickets and everything, so the Stack Overflow team is coming to New York City. I believe I'm taking like an overnight flight, so I'll arrive like really early on the 24th, which is a Wednesday.
Okay.
And we're staying until Sunday.
Well, if you get to the office before any of us do, just bring a big pen.
Or just and we'll unlock it.
Yeah, and then you'll be able to get in.
You know, what I'm more concerned about is, I ordered Fog Creek a whole Rock Band set out of completely selfish interest, of course, because I want to play when I get there. And you guys got to have that set up. I mean, even if you can't lock even if the doors are locked, just set it up like outside, in the hallway or something.
So well, all right, here's the thing. We have, let's see, the projector screen is installed but needs to be wired by the electrician so that you can cause it to descend. The projector itself has been ordered. The cabling for the projector is already in the ceiling but, you know, might be discovered to be flawed, which would be a catastrophe. The receiver has been ordered and the speakers have been ordered.
Good. So all that stuff should probably arrive by the 24th, I think. I mean, today's what, like the 10th?
I just have to get it all set up.
2 weeks.
I got an AV. I ordered an AV rack to rack it all up on. And, you know, the problem with like this AV gear, as I discovered, is the first time you install like receivers and DVD players and stuff, is that getting around to the back of them to hook up all like, what, 8 speakers that you have to hook up. So there's like 16 little screw terminals that you have to screw things on. And if you've got this like up in a closet somewhere on a shelf, it's a real pain to reach back there and screw on all these little speaker things.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but it's a one-time deal, though, theoretically. I mean, if you get it set up right.
Yeah, it is. But you the only way to do it that's even half reasonable is to somehow like hold this 75-pound receiver on your knee while you're standing on a stepladder, screw on all the connections on the back, and then put them up and hope that nothing comes undone. So so I ordered this rotating rack, which I hope works out well. So it's this rack that you install, and it like spins around.
And oh, wow.
It's the back.
It's like a Lazy Susan.
Yeah, I said a Lazy Susan. In fact, I took a Lazy Susan, which I didn't like, which had been being used for cheese, like a marble Lazy Susan, and I used it for my beach house audio gear.
Very cool. So hopefully the stars will align. We'll see how that goes. And then big news for me as a big fake plastic rock enthusiast. So Rock Band 2 does come out on Sunday. So I'm not really planning to get anything done except for launching the site, I guess.
Okay. Is it not Rock
Monday?
As a not Rock Band enthusiast, what is Rock Band 2 and what?
Well, Rock Band 2, mostly it's sort of the enhancement of the existing system. They didn't rebuild it from scratch. They just fixed a lot of the annoying sort of edge conditions in the first one. They did add some new features. Probably the biggest new feature is that you can play – there's a band mode called World Tour, which is essentially the campaign, where you and one of your friends or yourself, if you play two instruments – if you sing and play drums or sing and play guitar, you sort of go on a world tour with your band, and eventually you get into the Hall of Fame and – you go through all these cities and events and venues. And it's actually kind of fun.
Wait, they had that in the first version, didn't they?
They did, but you couldn't play online. So in that mode. That mode was strictly offline. So in Rock Band 2, that is an online mode. There's all these Battle of the Bands type events you can get into with other bands on the internet. You can also have people from the internet join your band as it goes on tour around the world. So that mode becomes a lot more robust, I guess you would say.
You're telling me about this.
They just really thinking,
what's going through your head is fun, 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 and what's going through my head is, do we have a Cat 5 drop in the AV closet?
Well, there is a wireless adapter for the Xbox 360. I did not buy that, but we can get it if you want because it's kind of pricey. You know, the console world is annoying because they nickel and dime you for every stupid thing, and I don't want to get the Wi-Fi adapter because it's like $90 for the stupid Wi-Fi adapter. But if we need it, absolutely, I will get it when I'm there. So if we need to, that's not a problem. And
no,
for local play, you know, you don't have to play with people from the internet. That's just a nice to have.
They always try to get you.
Yeah, so I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. They always get you to try to plug your Blu-ray player or your HD DVD player into the internet. And I'm like, no way. You're going to use that to break my HD DVDs that already work, aren't you?
Right. Well, yeah, like, for copy protection, sure.
That's literally what it is. It's that they can revoke things. And theoretically upgrade the firmware, but you know the firmware better work the day it comes out. Nobody's going to release a new Blu-ray disc or HD DVD disc. It's Blu-ray all. It's all Blu-ray now, right?
Yes, for high definition playback, I guess. Well, one advantage to having things connect to the internet, though, is particularly for games, is there's a lot of patching that goes on the console now. A surprising amount. It's almost like console games are becoming like PC games. They're still pretty stable because they target a fixed platform, so they can only be so buggy. But there's been quite a few games that have been released that have been pretty buggy, and they actually patch them after the fact. So you would actually want to be connected in that case because there would be a benefit to you, e.g. the game would stop being buggy and start working. And also they add features. Like, they've patched Rock Band a number of times and actually added things that were significant.
So how does that work? You put in the old disk and it goes, and it like downloads some fix for you automatically?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's something. There must be something in the loader that says, "Hey, I'm going to check the version on the server, and if it's greater than what I have, I'm going to." You know, sometimes you enforce the update. Sometimes, like, you literally can't play until you get the update because there's like exploits or something in the game, so you have to actually get the update. Some of them are optional, but yeah, generally it's nice. I mean, consoles are just becoming more like PCs, really, longer term. And I think PCs actually need, for the purposes of gaming, need to become a lot more like consoles anyway. They need to standardize more and have more control over the environment and stuff like that. I've been a long-time believer in the theory of synthesis. Have you heard of this? Some historian, I'll have to look it up on Wikipedia, but I remember in high school history class, this always made a lot of sense to me. You have thesis and antithesis, right? You have two things that are completely sort of opposite, like the console world where everything's locked down and there's no internet and, you know, the memory is very tiny on these cartridges. And then you have the PC, which is this totally open-ended platform that can do anything, connect to the internet, you know, the world is your oyster kind of platform. And then over time, they sort of evolve towards each other. And you see this a lot in sort of competing things, that they sort of evolve towards each other, and the ideas sort of merge together, or at least the good qualities of each idea merge together. And you can see this to a limited extent with, like, web apps versus desktop apps. Like, they used to be very different, right? The HTML used to be very limiting. You had that classic post about five things you can't do, which at the time was probably true.
Yeah.
But now you can do so much in the browser. The browser apps are taking on aspects of desktop apps, and the good desktop apps are taking on aspects of web apps. So I'm a big believer in this evolutionary model where these previously competing ideas start to become more and more similar over time. They just evolve towards each other. And I think console gaming is kind of like that.
Well, so now the game developers are going to get lazy, and instead of like really fighting to get a quality release, they'll just say, okay, we can always patch it later, and they'll throw it out there on us, and we'll have to learn to wait for the 0.03 version of every game.
Absolutely. Absolutely it does. Because in the old school console mindset, I mean, you had one chance. Like, you were shipping on a cartridge. That was it. You were burned into the ROM. It's like, you don't get patches. You either get it right or you fail.
Not only that, but your whole business fails because no game has a 2.0. You know, the game's done. They've played it. Nobody wants to play again.
That's right. Yeah.
I guess they did. There were classes of games like Civilization where, you know, or SimCity where basically every generation there would be a new version that would exploit the new generation. So many games were just one-offs.
Yeah, the game industry is a tough one because supposedly you make all your money in the game industry like in the first 2 months because, you know, that's why piracy is such a big deal to them. And they push so hard on that because if they lose like 10% of their initial sales, that's like 10% of all the sales they'll ever have.
It's also,
some games actually go in and patch away. Like they take away the copy protection after a certain time period because the sales just dwindle to a level that it doesn't matter.
It's also a hit business. So, like, one game pays one big success pays for the nine flops, which makes for a very different like way of financing these games. And it's hard to be a startup with just one game because you know it probably has a 90% chance of being a flop. You really have to have a portfolio of games before you start to have a good chance of surviving.
Yeah, it's interesting. The drug industry is like that as well. And you know, so many drugs are financed by the success of one or two blockbuster drugs.
Yeah.
Most drugs don't actually make a lot of money. And it's funny because there's so much research and development that goes into building them, much more so than software probably. So it's a very but the game industry is like that because building games is very, very expensive, right? Like we can build a business app like Stack Overflow. We build in, you know, 3 months. It's no big deal. But if that was a game with three people, there's no way. We just could not have done it. There's too many resources that go into it. Because I have tremendous sympathy for game programmers because think about all the things you have to optimize for as a game programmer. First of all, you have to be fast, like really fast, not like, you know, business app crud fast. But you have to actually run at a reasonable speed. You have like sort of cutting edge graphics and hardware that you're dealing with, right?
Yeah.
You want to be cool and look awesome, right? And then you have to optimize for the intangible of fun. Like nobody goes up to a business app and goes, oh, this is no fun. Well, of course business apps aren't fun. Nobody cares if they're fun. They're supposed to be, you know, do something semi-theoretically useful. But for a game, it's like you could have the best code in the world, the coolest graphics in the world, but it's just, quote unquote, not fun, right? Then you're lost, right? And how do you measure fun? How do you quantify fun? I have tremendous sympathy for game programmers because I think it's very, very difficult to get all that stuff right. And they actually don't get paid that well. It's sort of glamorous to be a games programmer, but very few games programmers actually get paid very well. So you work really, really hard, really long hours on something that may be a total flop that you can't control very well. So yeah, it's really risky. But then on the other hand, I went to the Penny Arcade Expo. Are you familiar with this?
Yeah. Wait, let me just interrupt you for a second, and then we'll come back to that. Sure. You said, like, how do you quantify fun? There is actually a bit of a science to that. You know, there are theories as to, you know, people have to be making progress. You can't stall them for too long on one level. There has to be a goal that's achievable, but not trivially achievable, and it has to be a certain distance away. And you have to have a sort of kind of steady diet of those little treats as you achieve higher and higher goals.
Right.
Which is sort of like the badges in Stack Overflow.
There is a little bit of overlap. I mean, the Stack Overflow, some of the systems in Stack Overflow are a little bit game-like. And I mean,
They're designed to make it fun.
Yes, yes. And you're right. That's sort of like the continual leveling up that you find in a lot of games, where you're always like one level away from something kind of interesting, so you want to just get one more level mm-hmm. and sort of see what happens. And in Stack Overflow, certainly the way reputation grows and the reason it grows is so that the system will give you additional things that you can do. Like, you have to have a certain minimum level of reputation to even vote on things, right? And mm-hmm. you need more reputation to vote down. Like, you have to sort of earn the right to give thumbs down to people's stuff. You need a little bit more reputation to edit, you know, wiki-style posts or re-tag a post. And then eventually, sort of the plateau of that, the big thing you're shooting for, is the ability to edit other people's posts throughout the system. That's at 2,000. So once the system learns to trust you, you can do almost – there's almost no dividing line. I think, to me, if the system is working, us as moderators and a trusted user who has like 4,000 or 5,000 rep, there's almost literally no difference between us. Mm-hmm. Like, I would like to build the system in such a way that there's no secret moderator menu. There is a little bit, because there's a few things we have to do that are like cleanup tasks. But for the most part, I would like us to be almost indistinguishable from the trusted users so that they can run the system.
The difference is that we're getting paid for this.
Yes.
We're doing our jobs, and they're having fun.
Yeah. Well, no, it's fun. I enjoy, like I've said many times on previous podcasts, I really enjoy working on Stack Overflow, and I really enjoy interacting with the community on it. Oh, and by the way, we got another sign of success. There's another Stack Overflow hating site that has just popped up. Somebody just emailed me today.
Oh, they just want free publicity from them. They just want me to mention their URL. So here's the www.disney.com/dvorak.org/blog.
Yes. Well, this one even has a logo, though, which is pretty impressive. It's a Crap Overflow, and they made the our little springy thing into like a toilet, you know, with water.
How did they get that domain name?
I don't know. I guess it was available. Crapoverflow.com. Yeah. But I'm reading this guy Ivan Hamilton, who emailed me about it. And actually, Ivan had a really negative interaction with the site. He's actually listing specifically. He was very excited to go on the site, and then he sort of lists the questions that he went to, and he was sort of very, very dissatisfied with the answers in each one. So at the end of them, he sort of concludes that there's too many incompetent developers in a nutshell, right? And the problem is the answers that aren't correct enough for Ivan's taste are getting voted up.
Yeah.
And he feels like if he puts in answers, they'll just be lost in the noise of the voting at that point.
That's nonsense. That doesn't have to – question after question, that's not what happens. And it is true that we're all, as developers, we're all hopelessly incompetent. And the goal of a site like Stack Overflow is to somehow share the correct knowledge, whatever, wherever it may be, as it is scattered throughout the universe, and to cause that to be voted up and to be spread amongst – you know, there's that – it's like this big universe of dumb programmers. and I'm one of them, and we all have like a little bit of knowledge. Like, I know how to do this thing in VB6, which may be useful to somebody one day who's trying to maintain some ridiculously old piece of crap. And we all have like these little tiny pieces of information, and if we can just contribute a little bit, that gets amplified. That information gets amplified, and maybe 1,000 other dumb developers will benefit from my one little piece of good information. And so it's really an amplifier of the good information in the system. And any other way that anybody else has ever discovered of doing it, other than the Stack Overflow way, does not filter in any way the good from the bad. It doesn't have any kind of this is good material or this is bad material. We're the only site that really has any attempt to in some way flag things. I mean, there's a little bit of like, okay, I accept this answer on other sites, and there's a little bit of other sites we're claiming that somebody is an expert. So not by virtue on these other sites, not by virtue of whether this answer is good, but by virtue of the fact that we kind of like you because you've had other good answers in the past, we somehow decide that your answer must be good. And I'm pretty sure Stack Overflow doesn't have any kind of history like that, other than the fact that you have karma. That doesn't mean that your answers go to the top of the puddle. You have to re-earn your right to have the right answer to a question every time.
You know what we need, Joel? We need a place where experts can go online and exchange information that they're experts on. I think if that's what we need. We just need a place for experts to come and exchange information.
You know, Dave Weiner used to say, and I doubted him, but I now have discovered that this is relatively true, that whenever you have somebody in the audience who's just basically throwing darts at you, it's just sort of pissing on everything you do and making these fake websites that talk about how stupid the whole concept is and just generally getting angry at the whole thing, 9 out of 10 times, it's your competitor. And I said, what? that can't be. Surely there are people that dislike what you're doing. But the truth is, people that dislike what you do, most normal people that just say this is not going to work, or I don't like this, or this is dumb, or this is not going to benefit me, will not spend any energy. They'll just leave. They'll be like, yeah, whatever, that's real funny. They won't spend any energy on it. The people that are actually actively spending time registering domain names, designing logos in order to piss on you, usually 9 out of 10 times, according to this Dave Weiner theory, they're your competitors. They're the people that have some skin in the game, and they need for you to fail. It's worth some of their effort for you to fail.
Really? That's interesting.
So,
I mean, it makes sense, because it does take a lot of effort to really, you know, and this critique by Ivan is really quite long. This is a fairly sizable blog post. I mean, it's
size. There are also just insane people. It's not necessary that they're...
There are also just insane people.
But no, you know,
I appreciate...
Maybe they're actually... Maybe they just have a stake. Maybe he's got, like, ridiculous karma at some other website that does Q&A.
I do appreciate, though, the action was very, very specific. Because so many times people, like, say that you suck. It's like they don't really explain why. But
right.
Ivan actually was very specific, and I do actually appreciate that. I don't entirely agree, because I think there's, like you mentioned, there's sort of the expert bias, which I think is kind of an illusion that you have all these experts waiting in the wings to do stuff. There's really just a bunch of amateurs trying to do things together.
Right.
I don't – and the people that are truly experts are too busy to even help, right? And if the experts are too busy to help, what difference does it really make if there are experts at all? Because the whole point of this endeavor is helping other developers. And whether you're an expert or not, if you have no time to help, you're not really contributing to the solution.
It's also, when you look at the questions, there are no experts on these particular questions. Yeah, I'll give you a great example. You know, I've been doing a lot of C# and ASP.NET. And so I'm good at, like, I don't know, 5% of the functionality that class library exposes to you and that framework, you know, 5% of it that I'm pretty good at. And so I'm sort of I've got a young programmer here who's doing some development in ASP.NET, and I got to code review him. And he'll come to me with questions like, all right, I've got multiple forms on a page, and how do I make the validator controls only affect the current form instead of all the forms on the page? And I don't know. I just don't know. Somebody does. Lots of people do, actually. I just don't know. No matter – even if I was an expert, you know, there will be things that I don't know. I remember there was a point in time where I was really deeply the expert on the old Excel macro language programming model, because I was going through every single line of that and trying to find ways to replicate it in Visual Basic. And I never knew as much about it as some of the people that had made careers writing macros in the old Excel macro language. thing. And there were areas that those so-called experts may not have known about, which I knew about just because I had read all and studied all the documentation. So, you know, you can't be an expert in one particular field, whatever the field may be, because these things have so many facets to them and they're so convoluted. There's so many little details. There's things that the designer, you know, the person that wrote whatever it may be, the document object model in the web browser, the person that wrote that very code may not really know how it's going to interact under certain circumstances, which happen all the time. And there may be somebody that has studied this on 27 web browsers and has a good answer for what you should do. So it's not really about – I mean, yes, you can be an expert, but your field of expertise is very, very narrow. And you don't have to go very far away from your field of expertise before you're as good as a newbie.
I totally agree with that. And the way I've characterized this in the past, it's kind of like a number in binary, right? So you start off with a bit, which is one or, you know, 0, 1.
Right.
And then as you go from left to right, you flip all those bits. And say you have like 6 bits. By the time you've flipped 6 unique bits, right, think how many combinations there are of what you're doing. Mm-hmm. So it was always amazing to me as a developer, it didn't take very long at all to get completely off the beaten path to where like virtually nobody is doing what you are doing. And it's not like you're doing anything weird. It's just you've made 6 unique decisions that are all independent of each other. And then software development is just kind of like that.
You wind up a good example where nobody's ever been.
Yeah, exactly. Totally agree. And a good example of what you're talking about, where even if you wrote the code, say you wrote the code, it's like, well, I'm an expert. I wrote the code, which actually does not turn out to be true a lot of the time. But you would think the person who wrote the code must really know this. They must be the expert on this. To go back to my Penny Arcade thing, so the Penny Arcade Expo, they had a panel with Harmonix. And Harmonix is the company that created Guitar Hero, Guitar Hero 2, and, of course, Rock Band, my favorite game. And the guy who wrote the code for scoring explained that after the game was out for a while, people were coming up with ways to get scores that he didn't understand. There were these ways to sort of – it's called squeezing, where you sort of trigger star power a certain way. Like you get extra points if you just – you sort of nudge the system a very, very specific way. He had no idea that this was even possible, and he wrote the code. So I think the community can end up, depending on who it is, can end up actually being smarter than any one expert, I think. It just takes an engaged community and a lot of engaged community to collaboratively sort of build the answers. And I think what I would tell Ivan in this case is I think he should have, if he had problems with the answers that people were giving, he should have left comments, right? We have this comment feature now where you can annotate answers. So if you feel like an answer is truly wrong, definitely leave an annotation on it indicating that. And I think annotations only take 50 rep, so you only need 50 rep to even do this. Mm-hmm. And other people would see the answer, and then they would see your caveat, oh, wait a minute, there's this huge bug in this algorithm, right? So, again, you're feeding back into the system. And, of course, vote it down if you really dislike it. So I think there's ways for this to work. And I can't really explain Ivan's reaction to it. I certainly haven't seen that much sort of wrong or bad information. I think some of it may be interpretation, where if you feel like there's – you shouldn't have to do any work. Like the top answer is always 100% correct, and you do not have to look at it critically. Maybe that's a misunderstanding of how the system works. I think if you're really into a problem or a question, you'll read pretty much every response there. There's not that many responses to most questions. I mean, 10 would be a lot, right? It doesn't take that much effort to read the question and then actually look at all 10 answers and sort of harvest the best information from each one. And I think that's just something you have to do on the internet. There's nothing about our system where we're going to guarantee that every bit of information you're going to see on there is going to be perfect. That isn't true, certainly, of Wikipedia or really any website you would go to.
So Ivan, get a girlfriend.
That would be my advice.
Yeah, Ivan just needs a girlfriend.
Ivan probably has a girlfriend. No, I like this post because I like specific criticism. It gives me specific things, and I, for one, appreciate that. But let's talk about something different. So last night, Joel was chatting with me online, and one thing that came up was one thing we're thinking about implementing, and you had some serious reservations around this, so I want to talk about it, is we want to give people one thing that's happening to us. We do have users that, for whatever reason, become negative users. In other words, they create accounts for the very purpose of just sort of messing with your system, and they have really nothing positive to add to the system. So we need a way to sort of block these users and prevent them from – I mean, we can just delete their accounts, certainly. But one thing I was envisioning was, and I got to be careful how I say this, was the ability for other users to sort of flag your account as questionable, right? Sort of like the way Offensive works now. We wouldn't call it Offensive, obviously, but the way Offensive works now, in case you don't know if you're not on Stack Overflow, if 10 people mark something offensive, that essentially removes it from the website. That's a soft delete. That's one of the very few ways that content can be deleted from the system. And it's actually working. I did a query last night. I hadn't been looking at all the deletes. I had just known the ones that I have done for various administrative reasons. There were a lot of deleted posts where people had hit this community threshold, and they had been deleted from the system. So we need something like that, but applied to users. And I think you had some serious reservations about that.
Well, here's my reservation, and here's where it comes from. You can either engage with people that want to have a fight, which is what they want, or you can disengage and they'll get bored and move on. And any attempt, you know, I never even started thinking this way until a way long time ago when Phil Greenspun wrote that he was having trouble with people, probably on photo.net, which is a very, very early version of Flickr that Phil Greenspun created in, I don't know, probably 1995. And they had one person, or maybe it was on LoseNet, which was his version of Usenet, only it was web-based. And they had one visitor who was just a troll, just a problematic person in the quaint old problematic way before problematic meant that it was the Russian mafia and they were trying to steal people's laptops and take their bank account numbers and so forth. This is sort of quaint where, like, you know, he was trying to talk about recipes on a photography discussion group or something, and so that was considered bad behavior in those days. Anyway, he was just a negative person, and they wanted to make him go away. But they thought, oh gosh, if we try to ban him, he's just going to make another account or use a different name or get a different IP address or find some way around the system, and he's going to be really angry. So he's going to have the motivation to do this. His anger will motivate him. And so instead, what they did is they changed the web server. They configured the web server so that when anybody came in from his IP address or maybe his range of IP addresses, the web server would return with timeout. It would basically just not respond, and it would just run some 30-second loop and then timeout. And the net result was that he just thought that the system was sucked. He just decided that the system was slow and badly built and gave up on it and went away. So Greenspun was bragging about this. Somebody can find the URL, I'm sure, to this story. It's all you got to do is find the third thing ever posted on the internet in the entire history of the world, if you can figure that out. Because, I mean, this is really, really early. And, you know, we adopted that method in the discussion groups that Joel on Software implements. And we did something even simpler, which is that when a moderator deletes a post on our discussion group software, which is it's commercially available. It's the discussion groups from Fogbugs. When a moderator deletes a post, the post is still shown as if it were not deleted to the person who posted it and actually to all the IP addresses in his range.
That's just sneaky. That's really sneaky.
Yeah, so people think this is cool. But the net result, I mean, it's just a very pragmatic thing. What happens is that if you delete someone's post and say we're deleting your post and they know about it, then they're guaranteed to be angry. And if they're angry, they're going to try to post. They're going to try to find their way around this. This is just human nature. When you try to block somebody, they get angry and they try to go around. They don't get angry and leave. They get angry and they try to fight. And so they try to take down the system, basically. Essentially, is they're going to start attacking your system in various ways. And they're going to try to look for ways around your blocking of them, and they'll find them because the internet, you're pretty anonymous. It's almost always possible to get a different IP address or to get a different user account name or something like that.
You know what this is like, what you described really briefly?
Yeah.
So FriendFeed has this feature where you can do a fake follow.
Mm-hmm.
Like the whole friending process is kind of, you know, a social landmine because people want you to follow them and you don't have time to follow them, so you don't follow them. So with this fake follow, what you can do is like, oh, I'll follow you, and it's like a fake follow. To them, it looks like you followed them, but on your end, like you're not following them at all. So what you're describing where you delete it for everyone in the system except for the person who created it is very much like a fake follow. For this one person, things look normal. Oh, nothing has happened. But to the rest of the world, you know, nothing is actually going on. So it's interesting that you would have arrived at that similar technique.
Yeah.
I didn't even consider that, actually.
Well, let me tell you, the end result of the similar technique is that sometimes people know you're doing this and they're angry. They are angry. But 9 out of 10 times, they just don't. And they think that their little troll post that they posted is being ignored. They really feel like it's being ignored. And they'll continue to post. And when they see that they're not provoking people because nobody else is seeing their posts, they'll give up and they'll move on somewhere else because it's just no fun unless they're – I mean, they're looking for a fight or a conflict because it's fun. It's like a game. And that's not – their type of game playing is not the type of game playing that everybody else in the community wants to play. And if you give them what they want, they're going to hang around. And if you deny them what they want, they're not. And what they want and what happens – I mean, I used to see this on IRC all the time in the old days. I'm sure it's still like this, but on IRC – the idea of IRC is you would chat, you'd meet friends, you'd the channels I went to, you'd go out on dates.
Where were you hanging out on Usenet, man? That's okay.
IRC. I think I got like 5 dates in 1 week and once on a certain channel, which will remain nameless because that'll give it away on IRC. But you're hanging out to socialize. And then there's a group of people who are – log on and they're addicted, so they're spending 12 hours a day on IRC, and they log on and they see that the people that are there they don't like, and they're kind of bored and they don't feel like chatting anymore, but they're addicted, so they need to do something with the system. So they kind of try to raise the ante. They're like, maybe I'll try to take over that other channel. The Melbourne people try to take over the Sydney channel, and you'll soon discover that you have to find and exploit various bugs in the system in order to actually take over a channel. But there is almost always a way to do it. And or you can try to take over somebody else's nickname so that their friends can't find them because you couldn't reserve a nickname in classic IRC. And this is exploiting the system basically to play a different game than the game in the system want to play, right? You got a bunch of people playing chess, but you want to play throw the chess pieces all over the park game.
And that is fun, just throwing the chess pieces. What an enjoyable game. It doesn't last very long.
Yeah, and then it becomes a kind of like a wrestling fighting game with hair and
that's awesome.
It's just a different game that the other people don't want to play. And so it's really, really important not to fall into the trap of playing the game that people want to play. So when somebody is being provocative or when they're being obnoxious or when they're trying to abuse the system in some way, they want to have the little "I'm having a fight on the internet" game, and none of us want to have this game on Stack Overflow. We'll have that game on your website, just not on ours.
Right.
And so it's really important to somehow, like, this is the don't feed the trolls method. You need the people to not be fed, and there's always going to be somebody there who is going to have the adrenaline rush of, oh my God, this guy's being obnoxious. How can I punish him? How can I fight him? How can I create some kind of fight? I can't go to sleep. Somebody is wrong on the internet. It's very, very hard. I mean, like a couple of years ago, I got into a flame war somewhere on Reddit, which is, I've learned that there's no point to this. I can't even remember what it was about, and I was ever so right.
A few years ago, that's shocking. I would have thought you would learn that much earlier.
Yeah, no, I
so
had
even Joel gets sucked in. Even Joel gets sucked in every now and then.
I wonder if anybody remembers this. I just got into a fight with somebody on Reddit over something. I don't remember what it was. I think he was. I'm sure it was something that I wrote on, and I don't remember.
Right.
Obviously, he was wrong. but it didn't matter. It was like, I cannot go to sleep because I have to see how he responds to my last thing so that I can respond to that.
Yes.
So what's the philosophy? The practical result we've had from this Fogbugs algorithm of just making the person see their things, but everybody else just kind of – they kind of disappear to everybody else has been – very successful because 9 out of 10 people don't know this is happening. And all else being equal, that means you only have about 10% as many disruptive users that you actually have to deal with.
Right. So let me distill this down to a recommendation. So this is all very interesting conversation and I think very useful, but how do we turn this into like actionable stuff we can do on the site? Because we still do have every now and then, it's really not a major problem at the moment, but we do see users who create accounts for the explicit purpose of just sort of messing around. And one thing that – and you talked about like not engaging with them, and maybe I'm not doing this correctly. Let me give you an example of one thing a user did. So a user created an account and he registered – it's always a dude, of course – registered an OpenID and actually posted a post which was all giant images and like this image of this 18th century French painter with this very, very funny image, actually, of this painter. Like, he's gesturing at the – it's a painting. He's gesturing at the viewer and, like, pointing and laughing. It's a very funny image. And I actually went and looked this image up because I was so intrigued by it because it had sort of a name on it. So I looked this guy up on Wikipedia. I'll link it in the show notes. So I actually went in and – it's awkward at the moment for us to delete users because there's a lot of sort of cascading deletes that we have to do and a lot of, key relationships that have to be there. And we haven't implemented this very well at the moment. So I couldn't actually delete his account. So what I did was I went in and I changed his account name to this French guy's name. Because he had posted that image. And then he went in later and actually populated the profile with all this guy's information. He created like a gravatar for him and everything. It was actually kind of funny, you know, but maybe I was engaging with the troll at that point. Like, I was encouraging the behavior when I didn't really mean to. So with these posts, these giant posts that he created, we just, of course, went in and A, edited them so they weren't giant anymore, and then B, deleted them. But what would you do in that case to this user? I mean, what would you do?
Okay, so there's two ways we could look at it. Number one, even the deleting of posts may be unnecessary. Like our current data model, the post is voted up and voted down, and it can also be deleted. And in fact, I think that the deleting is almost like just an extreme case of voting down, right? Like if something had minus 124 points, it should be as good as deleted. For all intents and purposes, it doesn't come up in searches. Maybe it comes up in searches, but only if there's literally zero other things that might come up. And in fact, a lot of these systems that work on voting, the only reason they even have a delete capability, and it's usually only given to moderators, is if somebody literally posts something that is actionable, like it's a copyright violation and you get a DMCA notice, you have to actually take it down. You can't just bury it. So that's the first possibility, which is, you know, maybe you'll find that the system just works well enough. It certainly does. This is something, Jeff, I mentioned to you when we were chatting last night, is if you look at the new submissions coming through on Reddit and Dig, it's 99.999% spam. I would not be surprised if it was that high, because a lot of people just set up these automatic scripts. Like, there are these online PR agencies that have these automatic scripts that submit every press release about every single one of their clients to Reddit and Dig. And it's hopeless.
Wait. Brief detour there. They don't have like a CAPTCHA around new item submission? Really?
Yeah, it might, but it's worth it. You know what? It's worth it to these PR agencies. They're getting paid to do this. But it doesn't matter. It's still spam just because it costs a penny. CAPTCHA is a myth anyway. CAPTCHA is easily broken, and it's especially easily broken now that there are these mechanical Turk-like ways of breaking it. You know, there are these not that I've ever found one of these, but there are these porno websites that'll give you a free account if you type in a CAPTCHA and that kind of thing. So there's mechanical ways to get people to do CAPTCHAs at very, very low cost. Getting CAPTCHA solved is so cheap that it's almost worth it for spammers, and it is in some cases.
I don't agree with that, but I don't want to go on a tangent, so keep going.
Let's put it this way. CAPTCHA is not waterproof. It does help, but it's not waterproof, and it probably won't be that helpful for long. But you know, go look at the new page on Reddit or on Dig, and you'll see just an awful lot of crap coming through, and an awful lot of people that have written scripts that sort of resubmit things, or that are just submitting a lot of garbage, CAPTCHA or no CAPTCHA. And I think you could try to moderate that, but it's almost not worth it. The stuff just gets voted into oblivion very, very quickly. And so the system itself does work. I don't think they need any kind of spam. I don't think they need any special protection on a website where they're really only showing you things that have been voted up in most cases. The protection that you need then is for people that have created fake shill accounts in order to get votes that they can use to vote things up. Okay, it's a little bit too complicated, but the whole point of that is it may not actually be necessary to really use this delete feature or the offensive feature, because it may be that voting is good enough.
Well, hold on, though, because we have posts that, even though they're downvoted, are giant posts. Like, they have images that are like 999 by 999 times 100.
Okay.
So editing them is awkward.
Yeah, but it doesn't matter. You can vote them down. Oh, you have to go into them and then vote them down.
Well, but the alignment of the page is completely messed up. I think this is where the Dig comparison breaks down a little bit, because Dig is just links. I mean, how are you going to grief somebody in 100 characters of descriptive text, right? We're more like Wikipedia in that you could grief somebody by creating a whole giant article, right?
Yeah.
Now, the advantage for us is it's very easy to undo. And this is something that's in the Clay Shirky book, Here Comes Everybody, is that it's so easy to undo vandalism that the effort required to undo it is an order of magnitude lower than it takes to do it. And that's how you win that particular battle.
Yeah.
Because there's lots and lots of people willing to click, roll back, or, you know, edit. And so very few people willing to build it.
So wait, I have an even better answer, though. So that was almost like an aside, which is that I kind of think that deleting may eliminate the need for that voting may get everything that you want from deleting. But even if that wasn't true, let's take it as a given that we have abusive users, and we can maybe detect that they're abusive because the number of things that they've posted which are called offensive is very high, or you know, some other reason. Let's say that we knew that somebody was offensive. Well, you have two possibilities. One is you can ban them, and then the next time they try to log on, you can say, "You, buddy, are banned." Well, what are they going to do? They're going to go piss on you every way they can. They're going to go make a new account. They're going to tell all their friends that you suck. They're going to go to the Crap Overflow site where they have their support group.
Community of outcasts. Yes.
Yeah. No, they're going to get back in, and they're just going to go try to delete everything because they hate you now. And you got in their face, and you've caused what's it called? An adrenaline rush. You've given them an adrenaline rush, which is going to make them more likely. It's a fight or flight reaction, and they're going to fight. Some of them will fight, but most of them will fight because it's on the internet, right? What can they do to what's? He's not going to come to my house, although that helps if you could go to their house.
Right.
So second possibility, let them keep posting. Just silently sort down everything that they ever post. You know what I mean? Just have it. You make a new field in the database called, you know, user quality, and everybody starts with a zero, and they get a minus one. And every time you're displaying something, the sort order is user quality, comma, rank, you know, vote. Mm-hmm. So now they're still there. They can see their post. There's nothing visible from the user interface that lets them even know in any way that they've been bad. It's just that they keep posting questions and nothing happens. And they keep posting answers and they just sort of wind up at the bottom of the page for some reason. And, you know, nothing that they do really matters.
Right. Just the same basic system, but A, don't just make it not visible that you're really interfering with them in any way.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of the solution you talked about earlier.
Hey, you know, I heard a trick which I've never seen used. If you've ever been on a plane where there's a passenger that's had about 18 drinks and is getting rowdy and the flight attendant refuses to give them another drink, or in a bar where the bartender's like, "I think you've had one too many. I'm cutting you off." That always turns into a fight. And there's always a guy with all the bravado totally embarrassing his date, being like, "Oh, I give so much money to this airline. I can't believe you would blah, blah, blah." And the guy's obviously drunk. And he's like, "I'm not drunk. I'm. So here's a trick that good bartenders know. Guy orders a drink. You bring him like a ginger ale or water if he's drinking vodka or something that basically looks like he's still drinking so that he doesn't lose face in front of his friends. And then you very, very quietly, so nobody else can hear, whisper to him. And you say something like, "Let me just give you a water for this one drink. If you want another drink later, you can have one. But finish the water first because I don't want you to get a hangover or whatever." You basically say something nice that's of the effect of you're not even announcing that you're not giving him a drink. You're going through the motions. You're letting him save face with his friends. You're not announcing to the world that you're cutting him off in a way where he feels like he has to stand up for himself. And you're also not even telling him that you're cutting him off. You're just saying, "Let's do water for this one drink. Next drink, you can have a regular drink." And hope that he will have forgotten by then.
Right. There's certainly aspects of that I think are very true, like not being confrontational and just sort of being more zen about the whole situation of like you're not going to escalate into anything weird.
It's also called passive aggressive. That's another way of putting it. Like, I will not engage. I will passively, you know.
Right. Also, like, I kind of disagree a little bit that you're supposed to disengage completely from people that are attacking. Like, I guess it depends on the attacker, but I found a lot of the people that are attacking are really just playing. And if you can sort of engage with them, kind of like what I did where I changed the guy's name to the picture that he used, he saw that I had actually taken an interest in what he was doing and actually, you know, didn't view it as totally negative. And although I obviously deleted his post, I didn't delete his account or anything like that. Maybe there's a half-step way where you can, you know, essentially turn your detractors into usable members of the community. Because this is the paradox. If you're motivated enough to post a long blog entry about how Stack Overflow sucks or, you know, do this griefing stuff, you're pretty engaged with the system, right? Most people don't care. That's the paradox of you know, that's why maybe, as Dave Weiner said, they're usually your competitors. Because who else would be have the time to work with something that they hate? Like, what's the value to them, right?
Why do they seem
I think
to
the
have
answer
some...
is they don't really – that whole – the thin line between love and hate. Like, there's something they like about your site. They're just not willing to acknowledge it, right? And if you can flip a bit there, maybe they can come back around or you can address what they're actually trying to complain about.
Absolutely.
I don't know. Maybe that's possible as well.
Sometimes it is. And sometimes, you know, one thing that I found very helpful when being a moderator or in a moderator role or even just when you get an email that seems idiotic in some way is just – pick somebody you love and imagine that they sent it. Like, imagine that this was an email from my dad. Like, what? Just visualize. Just have that visualization. And you say, wait a minute. Yeah. All of a sudden, you say, okay, maybe he's making a joke, and I didn't read it as a joke. I read it seriously. Maybe he really doesn't know how X, Y, and Z works. Maybe he's really young. Maybe it's a child. Because that happens on the internet and you don't know. Maybe it's not a native English speaker. And that's actually really common on the internet where things come across sounding a particular way just because the writer is not a native English speaker. And so, in moderating and in trying to figure out how to engage those people in a way that's more humane, I think, than we usually do, it's helpful just to imagine it's that nice old man that sells cigars on the street corner. And this is the person who's typing in this comment. And what would be a nice way to engage with them, you know, if you have the energy. Otherwise, just ban them. Ban them, I tell you.
Yeah, it's tricky. And that's one reason I think we've taken a while to implement this feature, because I don't know entirely how to do it right. And I agree there's a lot of pitfalls here. There's a lot of ways you can sort of turn people against you. And that's absolutely not what I want to do.
There's one more thing we might want to consider doing, sort of like the Amazon real names. Something where... I don't know if Google did it a reasonable way. I don't know if they still do this, where you got to give us a phone number of a cell phone and we're going to call it. And then we're going to read you a phone number and you're going to type it into the website. And then you get this special badge on your account that says that you are a little bit more unique because there's just a finite number of cell phones that any individual can control. So at least we know it's not a throwaway account where somebody is generating accounts for the purpose of spamming and then they're going to disappear.
Well, we have reputation achieves that for us, right? I mean, once you get a certain reputation level, it would just – there's no way. I mean –
No, but somebody could manufacture 10 accounts and have it 9 accounts vote up as one stupid thing just to generate reputation on that account.
Not enough to get to – it would be – yeah. I mean, it depends on how you set the level. But I think our reputation system does kind of work in that regard. So if you set the threshold to like 1,000, there's no way. It would take
months. It's working well enough. But I mean, what if you said that you can buy 300 reputation by giving us your real identity by paying us a dollar with a credit card? And the dollar just covers the cost of literally processing the credit card, because believe me, that's about all it does. And it guarantees us that you are a human being at a given address with a certain name, and it vastly reduces the amount of Now this isn't. I don't think we're anywhere close to needing to do this, but it is the cell phone and the credit card are two systems that some people have used when they really need to kind of raise the stakes and solve the problem of garbage generated fake accounts. That are being used to abuse the system in some very bad way. Like, you're getting thousands of posts a day from IP addresses from all over the world, and you just don't know how to prevent them.
Right. And to be clear, I mean, there's only been really isolated incidents of this. This is not like some large-scale problem. I just like to think it through, because as we want to go public Monday, that's the current date, I just want to make sure we have some infrastructure in place for dealing with users that are just really, you know, basically, I don't want to say evil because it's not really the right word, but really attacking you. And I want to have some strategy, because right now we have basically no strategy, and I don't think that's a good idea.
I have, every one of these sites that I know has basically started out with no strategy, including PayPal, started out with no strategy and then page faulted in a strategy. You got to wait and see how people attack and what particular problems actually exist. And then you have to build the specific defenses against the specific problems that you're specifically having. Because otherwise it's just too much work to build against every eventuality of every possible kind of person.
Right. And you bring up a really excellent point, which is my philosophy has been during Stack Overflow is to try to build based on the behavior I was seeing. Because you're mm-hmm. right. Otherwise, you're just – it's the classic programmer thing of like building these grandiose predictive systems that never really come to pass. It's like I do try to build features that target specific behavior I'm seeing versus what I imagine the behavior is going to be. So that's also the trick here is there haven't been really enough of the griefing to really have a coherent strategy yet. I'm sure that'll change once we go public. Hey, before we end the call, do we have any questions?
We do. And what's funny is that a lot of the questions that I queued up are actually directly – we actually talked about them just coincidentally because a lot of the questions are about things like reputation and karma. Let me play one from Clay.
Hi, Joel and Jeff. This is Clay Nichols, longtime listener.
By the way, let me Clay Nichols has this little company called Bungalow Software, and they make they've been in business for about, I don't know, I would say 10, 15 years. They make speech therapy software for people who have recovered from stroke or aphasia or something like that. So it's actually a very nice. It's nice that he's actually been kind of a software company success story doing something that is so helpful to so many people. So back to Clay.
First-time caller. I was a bit dubious about the idea of the badges. I figured we don't need no stinking badges. However, I think they'll work similar to medals and ribbons that we wore in the Navy. They let you really quickly distinguish someone's experience level and tell the difference between a nuclear power technician who got an automatic promotion to third-class petty officer with no experience and somebody who'd been busted back in rank 5 times, maybe didn't have a lot of rank, but had a whole lot of experience. So here's my question. Did the idea for badges come from Joel's experience in the Israeli military or from the flair on Jennifer Aniston's uniform in Office Space? Thanks.
Office Space.
Well, I'm glad he finds them useful because, and again, I know I've said this many times, but it really is true. Everything that's in Stack Overflow is in there for a very specific reason. There's nothing that's in there just for fun. Everything that's in there is to drive a certain kind of behavior. Now, any fun that you have is certainly welcome, and that's a goal as well. But the primary goal is driving good behaviors. And that's why a lot of times when people propose badges, I have to say to them, you know, that's funny as a badge, but it doesn't really drive the kind of behavior I want, so I can't do that. So I'm glad that other people are seeing the badges and actually getting use out of them. But really, it's neither of the above. I mean, the badges are based on the Xbox 360 achievements model, which has a very, very similar sort of structure. And as I've related on previous calls, you go in thinking, oh, these are meaningless achievements. It's like, who would bother doing this? And you get totally sucked in. And not only do you get sucked in by the achievements, you realize that the achievements are actually making you enjoy the game more, like on so many levels. Like other people can see them, they're public. You explore parts of the game you wouldn't normally have seen, so you have more fun. They work on so many levels, I'm very pleased with them.
Well,
so
Clay, having been in the military, I have to admit that my answer is the first because I did see actually the Israeli army is not big on badges, does not have a lot of medals that you can earn. But there are things you can earn, and in a normal 3-year military service that you do, you're going to get like 3 or 4 of them, and they're very meaningful to people. It's very surprising how something like that is meaningful to people. Long after I got out of the military, I was in college reading history, and I read a quote by Napoleon Bonaparte, who's famous for saying, "A soldier will fight long and hard for a bit of colored ribbon." And I think until you've done that, fought long and hard for a bit of colored ribbon, it just sounds silly, but there is actually kind of a lot of truth to that. You have to, if you create a system in which the little bits of ribbon are reflective of respect that should have been earned, then people will respect that system, and they'll fight for the ribbons. Great example, when I started working at Microsoft, it was back in the days of shrink wrap software. So everybody had a box with shrink wrap software for their products. And when you shipped a product, they would get a copy of the box with the shrink wrap and pass it out to everybody on the team, and they would stick it up on their bookshelf. And so as you walked around the hallways of Microsoft, seeing all these people and you didn't know who they were, some of them had one product up on their shelf, and some of them had like 10. And some of them had these really exotic and interesting products, and some of them had these ancient products. Like you were like, "Wow, that is the shrink wrap box of Microsoft Fortran 1.0 or something just like ancient for the or Microsoft. I think the oldest thing I ever saw. I'm trying to think, but I think I saw. I met somebody that had. What was that game? Adventure. It was like an Apple II game, I think.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Microsoft made a lot of the early games. Yeah. That's true.
So
that's
you see that on someone's shelf, and you're like, "Whoa, that's an old timer." And otherwise, you're walking around this company with 5,000 programmers. You have no idea who's who and who's done anything and what the hell they've done in their life and why you should listen to them or whether you should listen to them. But on their shelf there, some of them have like 10 things, and some of them have one thing, and some of them have nothing. And that was really meaningful to people, and they really like cherished. Getting those boxes to the point at which when they stopped actually making shrink wrap boxes, I think people were like a little bit jittery, but I still didn't know what to put up there.
Right.
And it's funny, they hired an HR manager who had been working, I think, at Apple to be head of HR for Microsoft. And he knew the concept, but just did not know the company. And so he came up with this idea called the Ship It Awards that you got for shipping software. And what it was is you got to slab of Lucite if you didn't already have one, and they would stick these little bronze stamps on the slab of Lucite every time you shipped some software. And the Microsoft community hated these. They loathed them. There's a scene in that book, Microsurfs, where they're trying to destroy one with a blowtorch, and that is not an exaggeration because there already was a system by which people got respect for what they had worked on. And the senior developers at Microsoft, you go into their office and they'd have 18 interesting, famous applications that had made a lot of money up on their shelf. And then they got this slab of Lucite that had one little stamp on it because all it had is what they shipped last year because the Lucite thing was invented, you know, much later. And so it was this quasi-attempt to make a badge system that actually did not reflect what you had done, that did not show any knowledge or respect of an existing Microsoft culture. And it really teed people off. It really, really pissed people off. So anyway, that's my little story. I think that it is kind of surprising how much this matters. And it's really about like respect and credibility. And when you get to a large enough community where you don't actually know everybody, it's not just a family and we don't know your history. It's not just your classroom and maybe you've been with these kids for 5 years and you know who's who. You know, maybe it's a big company of 5,000 people, or it's the internet with a billion people, or Stack Overflow with thousands and thousands of people you've never seen before. And you know, we need to have a way of showing you who's who and what they've accomplished and how long they've been here. On people will make it if you don't give it for them. On Slashdot, everybody talks about how many digits are in their Slashdot user ID number because it's, you know, a sequential integer. But that's something that it's kind of hard to earn, that kind of credibility. And Slashdot was never really explicit about giving you very many kind of badges or anything that were that visible.
Right. Well, we're probably at the hour limit.
We are.
I feel bad we didn't get to too many questions, but you said we maybe I'll get the names from you so I can list the questions we actually did answer in sort of a drive-by way.
I don't really know what they are, and some of them are more specific. We're starting to get a lot of pretty detailed questions about like how should this particular thing in Karma work. For example, I don't want to go into it today, but you know, somebody was asking, and they came up and asked me this at the Business and Software Conference as well. If you edit your own post a bunch of times, why does it flip into community mode? Because it's just you, and it's just your post. It should be yours. So you know, these are like
there is a reason.
Oh, okay. You better just. You gotta just say it.
Well, the reason is there's certain users that were using this as a way to continually bump posts.
Oh, they were using it. They were doing it so that their posts would come up new.
Yeah, or in other subtle ways, like they would edit posts where they had a really high ranked answer.
So that other
so they're editing someone else's post.
Got it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's a little tricky.
But these are, you know, these are relatively small details. We're going live to the entire universe next week, and we're either going to have a deluge of newbies who are going to mess up the whole thing, and it'll be a disaster, or or we're going to have great new behavior caused by the fact that suddenly Google can find answers, and now you can use Google. I don't know how long that'll take, but now you'll be able to use Google to type questions, and you'll start getting results from Stack Overflow, and that will actually bring. I think what that will do is that'll bring a lot of attention to the very, very, very niche questions that right now just don't have any community finding them because they're like, you know, there's maybe 10, 20 people working on this technology in the universe. Yeah. So I think it's really valuable for us to get live, and I think we'll start to see some different behavior when that happens, and we may want to reevaluate what we want to do. So I think the theme of this entire show has been about the anthropology of writing software.
Right.
How when you're creating social software in any way, you have to think like an anthropologist. You can't think like a software developer anymore. It's all about like how do people work on teams and what's right. Yeah.
I like to view it as just encouraging the behaviors that you like and discouraging without punishing. So that's the fine line. We talked a lot about that. The behaviors that you don't like. Because there are uses of the system that I don't consider valid, but I'm not going to like go in and step on them. Right? Because if people want to use it that way, that's fine. Right? As long as they're not hurting anything, as long as they stay on topic broadly in terms of just, okay, it's about programming in some way, I'm fine with that. So it's a very fine line. It's a very, very much a balancing act. Yeah. And you don't want to turn the crowd against you, because I think that's the whole point of this, is to have a crowd that sort of gets behind what you're doing and enjoys building the system. So the minute you turn it into an us versus them, I think you're lost. And like, you know, like the whole Friendster debacle from early on. And yeah, but yeah, it's tricky. And we're trying to be very careful about how we do it. We really are. So any questions like that, please send them in.
Let me just write down that mispronunciation so I could.
What did I mispronounce?
No, I'm not going to say it on the air. I'll tell you about it afterwards. Sorry, just take notes. Okay, we got some announcements. I think we sort of let it slip that we're planning now to go live early next week, probably Monday. That Fog Creek is going to be in chaos because we're going to be in boxes. So there's actually a chance that you may push us live, and I won't really announce it on Joel and Software until I can somehow get my computer to come back to life. But we'll try. We had some other announcements. Oh, yes, I have something I want to mention. We are, I believe, looking for a sponsor for this podcast. And it's very much like a, what's the word, NPR style sponsorship. Those of you that have been listening here on ID Conversations, they're spending a lot of money and putting a lot of effort into this. And they actually wanted to line up Audible.com, which makes those audiobooks that are all DRM'd and yucky, and if you change computers, they get deleted. And they wanted to line them up as a sponsor for the show, but the requirement was that we had to interrupt the show, and you and I, in our own words, had to talk about how great Audible is. So I basically, Doug and I talked about that, and we completely vetoed that idea big time, although they would have been happy to provide a significant sponsorship. If you are at a company that makes products for developers or that just generally wants to help out with this podcast by underwriting it in exchange for somebody quietly saying this show is sponsored by such and such a company at the beginning and at the end. And I think, you know, Doug said, what did he say? Did you see that email?
Probably.
But by the end of the month, 30 or 40,000 people have listened to every show. It's actually more than I thought. So a bunch of people hear it, and it's a good way to you know, use your company's name or get good reputation in a way. So if you're interested or able to sponsor this weekly podcast, go ahead and send me email at joel@joelonsoftware.com. That's a different email address than we use for questions for the show, which should be sent to podcast@stackoverflow.com. And if you send in questions for the show, we want to be able to play them and let people listen to them. So send them in MP3 format or in a WAV or UGG Vorbis are all good formats so that we can play the audio version on the air. There's something called Blog Talk Radio you can use if you don't have a microphone on your computer and you want to record audio. It's a phone number you can call. And it puts an MP3 up on the web for you.
Right. And don't forget our
We have a wiki for the people that want to either be able to search the archives of the show and not listen to the whole thing, or they just want to read it. And the transcript wiki is also located at it's located at stackoverflow.fogbugs.com, and there'll be a link in the show notes. And we always get a bunch of people going in there whom we thank, and just transcribing a minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes of the show, which has been very valuable and very helpful to people. Usually the whole thing is transcribed in a day or two. It's just awesome. And that has been very helpful to a bunch of people who can't listen to the audio version for whatever reason. So,
right. And we actually have had those quoted back at me. So you can hold me to my previous claims if you create a transcript of what I said. So there is value there.
So that's a very nice volunteer effort that follows. That's, I think, all we have. So we'll see you next week.
See you next week.
You've been listening to Stack Overflow with Jeff Atwood and Joel Spolsky.
The post-production audio engineer for this program was Joel Spolsky. Our website editor was Jeff Atwood. The series producer is Jeff Atwood.
This is Phil Windley. I hope you'll join me next time for another great presentation from Stack Overflow here on IT Conversations.